The year is 354 AD. The place is a small town up in the north of Africa. The occasion, Monica has a baby boy. The baby boy's father was a man of learning, but he was a pagan. He had a vicious disposition, and he had no regard for character. Monica, on the other hand, was a woman of God. She was devout, she was prayerful, and she was godly. Together, mother and father brought up this new baby boy until he was 17. That's when he left home. He left his little town and went to Carthage, a big major city in the north of Africa. He went there to attend university, and that's when the trouble began. He got in with a rough crowd, he moved on to the fast lane, and he became engaged and involved in all of the debauchery of university life in the north of Africa. And he spiraled down. It, of course, was to the heartbreak of his mother, Monica, who was praying for him daily and who was grieving over the direction that her son had chosen to take. Sometime later, at 29, unknown to his mother, he sneaked away from home and headed for Rome, crossed the Mediterranean, came to Rome, and found a fast crowd and a wild crowd, and continued his life of total uselessness and wastefulness. He left Rome shortly after that, though, to go to Milan, not too far from Rome. And in Milan, two things happened. That's when Monica caught up with him. And they reconnected. He was now 29 years of age, 30 years of age, 31 years of age. And Monica has connected with him in Milan. But the second thing that happened in Milan was that he came under the influence of St. Ambrose, who was the bishop of Milan. That was when his conflict began, because he was influenced because of the character and the scholarship of St. Ambrose, but he was still playing with the life that had been his life for the last 10 or 12 years. And so an enormous struggle came into his life. We're talking about struggles. His struggle was the life of the university students and wild city of Rome and the new kind of life and the new standard of life of St. Ambrose, who was a significant influence just by his demeanor and by his input into this young boy's life. And the struggle continues for 2 or 3 years. These are the most unhappy years of his life because of the conflict of two styles, two ways of life, two philosophies of life, two lives. And the conflict is intense. His mother, Monica, is praying earnestly, praying faithfully, praying diligently for him. One day, the struggle comes to a peak. And he runs out of his home, throws himself in the garden, and sobs in the grass. He's just torn to pieces with the struggle. In a moment of quietness, when he stops to take a breath, he hears the voice of a young girl over the fence next door. And the voice says, "Take up and read. Take up and read." And so he sits up and he takes up his Bible, flips it open, and his eyes fall upon these words from Romans 3. "Let us walk honestly as in the day, not in rioting and drunkenness, not in chambering and wantonness, not in strife and envying, But put ye on the Lord Jesus Christ, and make no provision for the flesh to fulfill the lusts thereof. Imagine, of all the verses in the Bible that his eyes could have fallen upon, those two verses, 13 and 14 of Romans chapter 3. And God spoke to him through those verses. And that was the moment when he did what his mother was praying for most fervently. She would oftentimes write and say that her only major ambition in her life is to see her boy converted to Christ. And that happened that afternoon. Who am I talking about? Who? St. Augustine. He became the Bishop of Hippo. He became one of the great church fathers. He was known as the meekest of men. He was a brilliant scholar, and he was a man of God. But for our purposes this morning, the most astonishing thing about him was that Psalm 119 was his favorite chapter in the Bible. He loved Psalm 119. It was his primary focus of study in his own personal life. He would talk about it, reflect upon it, so much so that his friends urged him to write a commentary on it. He said, "I could never do that. It is so deep and so profound, I cannot fathom the depths of it." He was just overwhelmed with Psalm 119. Well, in the course of his life, guess what happened? Well, two things of interest happened. The first thing is that he decided at the end of his life to write a commentary on Psalm 119. Having done that, he decided the second thing he would do was write a autobiography, the story of his life. And that story of his life is one of the classics of English literature. Anybody studying theology is compelled to read the classic, even without Christian theology. It's one of the classics of ancient literature. The title of the book? The Confessions of St. Augustine. Now, he patterned that book after Psalm 119. Now, you know enough about Psalm 119 to understand what I mean when I say he patterned the book after Psalm 119. Just to refresh you, the pattern of Psalm 119 is it's not an exhortation, it's not a meditation, it's not an admonition. What is it? It's a conversation between him and God. And that's how Psalm 119 comes out. And that's what his Confessions of St. Augustine is patterned after. So if you like Psalm 119, you may want to sometime pick up the Confessions of St. Augustine. When I was studying this past winter, I went to a used bookstore, and I got the Confessions of St. Augustine for $2. And it was interesting because it was a huge, big book, a secondhand bookstore. And as I walked in, the owner of it was working around one of the shelves. And I said to him, "Would you just happen to have a copy of St. Augustine's Confessions?" And he says, "I know exactly where it is." And he walked back, and we walked in around, and he stopped at a shelf, and he reached up, and he pulled it off the shelf. I have no idea why that happened or how that happened. But it's one of the great, great classics. And the interesting thing is that its style is patterned after Psalm 119. Now you know why I have called Psalm 119 the Confessions of a Struggling Person or Struggling Man. Because that's what it is. It's the Confessions of a Struggling Man. And my title for it is just patterned after Augustine's title for his book, the Confessions of St. Augustine. Well, that raises, of course, the question about confessions. What on earth are we talking about in confessions? If you looked up the word confession in Webster's, you would find out that a confession is an acknowledgement. It can either be positive or negative. Well, now that's interesting, isn't it? A confession can either be a positive thing or can be a negative thing. And that's the way they are. For example, in the Christian faith, we talk about confessions. But there are positive confessions and negative confessions. We talk about a confession of sin and a confession of faith. When did he confess faith? So a confession is simply an acknowledgement. To Augustine, a confession was an admission of guilt and an act of worship and praise and thanksgiving to God. So Augustine's confessions have the negative side and tells about his ranky old life, and the worship and praise to God. There's the admissions, and then there's the acts of praise and worship. And that's what you've got in our Psalm of 119. It's the confessions of a struggling man. There are some confessions that are negative, and his admissions about things that are going on in his life, and his bad attitude, and his struggling, and then there's some wonderful expressions of worship and devotion to God. So that's where we are in our study this morning. We've talked about the soul, the person who is writing these confessions, and we've talked about the struggle that he's having in his confessions, which, by the way, is just exactly a parallel with the struggles that Augustine had all during those young years of his life. And then the confessions. And we're this morning at the subject of confessions. Now, I've got to confess to you that this is very difficult to do. And that's because we're dealing with an acrostic. And that makes it very difficult to do. If I was writing Psalm 119, I would have done it differently. And that's because I wouldn't be doing it to aid your memory. I'd be doing it to make your study easier. And so when he comes to his confessions are scattered all over the book. And what you've got to do is read the book over and over and over again and start finding out what the streams are in his confession. And then put those verses all together. And here you've got 12 verses. Now, if I were writing the book, the chapter, I would have started the chapter with those 12 verses. Not so with our book. Because in the Bible, it's those 12 verses are scattered through the book, and you have to sort them out and bring them in. Okay, that's the first stream. Now, I think I've put together a little pattern here that will suggest that there are four streams in his confession, four streams in his acknowledgments. And those four streams contain a variety of, each stream contains a variety of verses that are scattered through the book. So what we're going to do this morning is take you through those four streams, and we'll stop at each one, and we're going to look up a few verses in each stream. If you were really going to do a real study of it, then you would want to stop with each stream and go through the whole book and identify as many verses as you could that would fit into that stream. I've selected just a few verses to give you the idea of it. So what were the four streams? Well, there on your screen you see the picture of a cord. And that's what I want you to be thinking of. This cord has four streams. Now, if you get a hold of this morning, this is going to change your life. That's my prediction. That's a pretty radical prediction, isn't it? But I think it'll do that. Because what it will do is it'll give you a pattern on how to talk to God, have a conversation with God when you're struggling. Now, if you don't have any more struggles the rest of your life, then you won't need this. But if you happen to have another struggle or two, how do you talk to God when you're struggling? Well, that's a little remarkable, isn't it? Because most people don't talk to God when they're struggling. They're so angry, they're so mad. They don't talk to God. They get angry with God. And instead of talking to God, they pout. They turn to themselves. They turn inward. And they reflect on themselves. And am I to blame for this? And what have I done wrong? And why do I deserve this? And they're feeling sorry for themselves. So most people, when they go through struggles, don't turn to God. They ignore God. He's the bad guy. And they look at themselves and they feel sorry for themselves, or they get down on themselves or beat themselves up. They start to pout and so on. It's very interesting. Psalm 119, that's not how it happens. What David does is he, first of all, turns to God. So stream number one on the chord of his confessions is his conversation with God. And his conversation with God about whom? God. It's his conversation with God about God. He boldly converses with God about God. Now let's look at some verses in the Bible that will sort of give us that picture and what he's doing in his conversations with God. If you've got your Bible, let's turn to some. I'm going to turn to verse 73. Let's look at verse 73. Your hands made me and fashioned me. They give me understanding that I may learn from your commandments. Now that's a picture of the greatness of God and the sovereignty of God. You put me together. You designed me. You made me. I'm your product. If you look on a little bit further to verse 89, it talks again about the sovereignty of God. Forever, O Lord, your word is settled in heaven. Now, if you read through the psalm, you would find a number of verses that would highlight the sovereignty of God, the godhood of God. When we talk about the sovereignty of God, we simply mean God's God. That's what we mean. We mean that he's number one, that he stands above and beyond us. He's absolutely sovereign. And it's really interesting, I think, that oftentimes as he's in the middle of those struggles, you can just see David sitting back and he's saying, now listen, God, I know who you are. I know who you are. You're God. You made me, you put me together, you know the pieces. You're in charge of all the circumstances of my life. And your word, whatever your word says, whatever you say, it stands solid and it happens. So it's a great testimony to the sovereignty of God. Look over to verse 142. Psalm 119, verse 142. What's he say there? Your righteousness is an everlasting righteousness, and your law is truth. So he focuses upon the righteousness of God. Now, the righteousness of God simply is God's actions, always conforming to the standard of God's character. God's character is holy. God's character is such and such. God's word is such and such. And God's actions balance and meet perfectly his word. God has said this, he's promised this, and his actions balance that. That is the righteousness of God. And so he bears testimony to the righteousness of God. Look at verse 140. Verse 140. He says, your word is very pure, therefore your servant loves it. Now, in one of the translations, it says, your word is wise. And so he speaks of the wisdom of God. And I love verse 90. Look at verse 90. It says, your faithfulness endures to all generations. Only speaks of the faithfulness of God. Look at verse 118. Verse 118. You reject all those who stray from your statutes, for their deceit is falsehood. So he speaks of the holiness of God, another one of the great characteristics of God. And then in verse 151, if you're still with me, verse 151, you are near, O Lord, and your commandments are truth. So he speaks of the truthfulness of God. And I love verse 168. I keep your precepts and your testimonies, for all my ways are before you. You know my ways. Every dimension of my life, every action, every circumstance, every situation, you're the all-knowing God. And we would call it the omniscience of God. He bears testimony to the omniscience of God. In verse 64, the truth, the earth, O Lord, is full of mercy, and teach me your statutes. So he speaks of the mercy of God, and that has been translated in other translations, the love of God. And then the last one I'm going to give you is 129. Verse 129, your testimonies are wonderful. Now that's just a taste of it. You could multiply that. But what he does, ladies and gentlemen, is he simply talks to God about God. He reflects on the character of God. He affirms the nature of God. That's how his confession begins. Now that's really important. Because when you're struggling, you generally begin with yourself. But when he's talking to God, he begins by talking to God about God. And I think that's really key. I'm reading a book right now called A Call to Spiritual Reformation by Donald Carson. It's a very, very good book. He begins the book by asking us, what do you think is the number one need in the Evangelical Church of North America today? Now, that's a fair question. What do you think is the number one need? And then he goes through about six major needs that we would all agree with. He talks about the circumstance, the situation, and boy, that's a need. But then he'd end it and says, that's not the major need. Then he'd come to another one. I say, ah, boy, that's great. No, big, important, we need that, but that's not the major need. He goes through about six different needs, and then he says, now, what is the number one need? And this is his conclusion. Do you buy it or not? This is his conclusion. It's to get to know God. It's to get to know God. Now, why do you think I told you the story of Augustine at the beginning? Well, I wanted you to understand the connection with Augustine in Psalm 119. But I also want you to understand there's a big difference between knowing about Augustine and knowing Augustine. See, I know a few things about him. You know a few things about him now, too. But I don't know him. If we were to bring Monica up here, one of his peers, he'd say, hey, Bill, just sit down. You don't know Augustine. Let me tell them about Augustine. And that's the difference between knowing about Augustine and knowing Augustine. And the same thing is true with God. We all know a lot about God. But do you really know God? I think that's what he's saying. But you know God. How do you get to know about God? Well, you study theology. And that's how I got to know about God. As a matter of fact, I've read a lot of books in my lifetime, just like you have. But the most influential book that I have read, apart from the Bible, the most influential book I've read was given to me when I was 19 years of age, the leader of our young men's Bible study at the chapel in Toronto that I attended. And he said, Bill, I want you to read this book. It was the best book I've ever read in my life. It was a book by A.W. Tozer, and it's called The Knowledge of the Holy. Now listen to this. Chapter 1, paragraph 1, sentence 1. This is how the book begins. I'm a smart-alecky 19-year-old reading this. This is how the book begins. What comes into your mind when you think about God is the most important thing about you. And I said, oh, no, it's not. There are a lot more things about me that are more important than what I think about God. But I read through the chapter, and he sold me on it. Because he pointed out that everything about me is a reflection of what I think about God. How I handle my money, how I cope with success, how I cope with failure, how I treat people. Everything about me is a reflection of what I think about God. How I do my job, how I relate to the neighbor, everything about me is a reflection of what I think about God. So he sold me on it. By the end of the chapter, I bought what he's saying. The most important thing about me is what comes into my mind when I think about God. Well, of course, then that raises the question, what on earth comes into your mind when you think about God? And what's the first thing that ought to come into your mind when you think about God? Now, don't check me out. Don't turn me off here. Because my answer is going to be pretty simple. And here's the answer. The first thing that ought to come into your mind every time you think about God is that he's God. That's what we mean when we talk about the sovereignty of God. The first thing that comes into your mind when you think about God is that he's God. He's God. He calls the shots. He's God. He's sovereign. He's able to do exceedingly abundantly beyond anything that you could ask or think. He's absolutely wise, and in his sovereignty, he does what he's God. Well, that's pretty impressive. And I think that's exactly what the psalmist is telling us in Psalm 119. If he was going to write his conversation in logical order, not in acrostic order, but in logical order, I think he would have given me 15 or 20 verses right at the beginning that told me what he thought about God. And he was just telling God what he thought about him. He says, God, you're wise. I know that you're powerful. I know that you know all about me. He just talks about God. Why do you think he does that? Well, has a way of affirming to me who I'm talking to, affirming to me where I'm in this struggle that's going on in my life. It gives me a framework for dealing with that struggle that you're in right now. That struggle is in the middle of a framework, and the framework around it is God. And this is the kind of God. He's faithful. He's holy. He's merciful. He's gracious. Get all the attributes there. How many could you add? How many could you list? Get all the attributes. That's him. Now, you know a lot about God. But do you know him? Well, there's a big step between knowing about God and knowing him. To get to know him takes some time. It's involved in going through a few experiences. Learning and failing and watching and seeing and interpreting and getting to know God, spending time with him. Now, so the psalmist has got to know God. And he says, I know, God, that you're faithful. I know that you're gracious. I know that you're merciful. And that becomes the context for dealing with the conflict and the struggles that are going on in his life. Earlier this summer, Marilyn and I were at a conference where I spoke. A conference that was for families with special needs children. It was a phenomenal experience for us to see these mums and dads with all these special needs. And it's a great conference. They did a great thing for these parents. And my privilege was to speak to them. In the course of the conversation, I spoke to one of the mothers. And she said, let me tell you what happened about 2 hours after I gave birth to my child. And I discovered that my child was severely handicapped. By the way, you don't use that word anymore, you know. Special needs, not handicap. Special needs. But she said, I discovered that he was severely handicapped. And she said, I found myself saying to God, I can't do it. I can't do it. She said, I saw myself living the rest of my life in a prison. And she said, Lord, I can't do it. I can't do it. And then she said, I remembered that Paul, when he was in prison, said, rejoice in the Lord always. And again, I say, rejoice. And she said, I thought about that. And then I said it again. Lord, I can't do that. I just can't do that. And then she said, I thought about it again, the verse, and it said, rejoice in the Lord. Rejoice in the Lord. So she said, Bill, do you know what I did? It was just just hours after her delivery. She said, I laid my head back on the pillow, and I thought about all that I knew about God. I just thought about it. I went through all of the attributes of God. I just reflected on all that I knew about God. And she said, that turned my life, my whole perspective on it. So when it comes to dealing with the struggles, the way we deal with it, the way we cope with it, is with our confession. And our confession isn't a negative. Our confession is a positive. We confess who God is and that we love him. We recognize him. We understand. We know he knows. He's God. And the more we do that, the better we'll get to know him. And the better we get to know him when we're doing that, it'll be so much more personal. I know this, Lord. I know this. It's not because I read it in a book. I know that. I know this is the kind of God you are. So that's the first thread, the first cord, or the first first thread, really, in the cord. He just says, you are. Now that's talking about his character. You say, that's talking about what he says. You do, this is what he does, what you do. And those are the three lines. You are this, you've said this, you've done this. And you just work with those three lines, and you just tell God everything you know about him. All that you do, all that you know. That's how you start. You don't start with feeling sorry for yourself. You don't start with being angry with people. You start with God. That's number one. Now, what's the second thread that's in the cord? Well, the second thread is telling God what you're struggling about. It's just acknowledging the struggle. And that's what David does. I've read that to you in the past, but the greatest stanza in the psalm on that is verses 81 to 88. And there he just pours out his heart on the things he's struggling with. And you'll know, you will remember, won't you now, that there are about 40 different afflictions that he identifies in his struggles. So the second step in our confession is simply expressing, understanding, and telling God about our struggle. Now that's therapeutic in itself. When you're in the middle of struggle, it's neat to be able to express it and share it with somebody. Try expressing it to God. Just explaining it to God. I feel this way. I really was hurt. I'm struggling with knowing what to do, this way or that way. You just acknowledge it before God. Just lay it out. And we could do that with a number of verses, but we've already done that. So that's the second thread. And then the third thread in this cord is you say, I need you. I need you. And you fill out what you need. I need wisdom. I need grace. I need understanding. I need patience. I need love. I need a forgiving spirit. You just spell out what you need in this situation. You need a friend. You need a job. You just spell out what you need. And that's what David does in this psalm. And I'm not going to take time because I want to throw it open for discussion here in a minute. But I could take you to some of the things that he expresses. Those are his pleas. And if you do what I did and read through the psalm and just look for things that he pleads for, things that he asks for, you'll see that there are 89 of them in the psalm. 176 verses and 89 pleas. I need this. I need this. I need this. And he's just, it's an unburdening of his soul and laying it out before somebody that he knows real well, someone who's built a good relationship with and that he's already acknowledged. So I need you. This is what I need. You lay that before him. That's the third. And what's the fourth thread then? The fourth thread is, I commit. I commit. And you make a commitment to the Lord. And I'm going to read you some of the commitments that David makes, because he has some amazing commitments. I found 20 of them in the psalm. And this is what I'm going to, let me just read them to you. I am yours. I am your servant. I have promised to keep your word. I treasure your words in my heart. Now I keep your word. Your servant meditates on your statutes. I have kept your statutes. I cling to your testimonies. I observe your testimonies. I have done justice and righteousness. I have chosen the faithful way. I do not turn aside from your love. I have restrained my feet from every evil thing. I hope for your salvation. I believe in your commandments. I do your commandments. I have not forgotten your law. I do not forget your commandments. I shall not forget your word. I will never forget your precepts. Now there's just sort of a flood of commitments to him. And that's a neat way to conclude this interaction with God when you're in the midst of a struggle. What are you going to commit yourself to? So there's the flow. And I just want to recommend to you that kind of flow in coping with the struggles that we all have in our life. And one of the ways that we do it in our Christian faith is we begin with an acknowledgement of who he is. And then, this is a struggle. This is what I need. Now, God, I'm committed. I'm committed to you, committed to your word, committed to your love. We commit ourselves to it. That's the message of Psalm 119. Those are the confessions of a struggling soul. Those are the confessions of a struggling soul. And the product of that will be immeasurable in our lives. I think that's what brings it together and puts together things in our lives that will ultimately be to God's great glory. I think superimposed upon all of this is a poem that I've lived by and died by in some cases sometimes, but shared many, many times. The poet put it this way: my life is but a weaving between my Lord and me. I cannot tell the colors he weaveth steadily. Oft times he weaveth sorrow, and I in foolish pride forget he sees the upper and I the underside. Not till the loom is silent and the shuttle cease to fly shall he unveil the canvas and explain the reason why. The dark threads are as needful in the weaver's skillful hand as the threads of gold and silver in the pattern he's planned. It's that kind of perspective in the midst of our struggles that will enable us to confess. You are, you say, you do. I am, I need, and I will. Lord, I just pray that you will Just this morning, encourage hearts that you will equip us and prepare us from the model of this psalm to be ready, better prepared, and able to deal with the struggles that are inevitable in all of our lives in the days that are ahead. Thank you for the pattern that emerges from this psalm that will be a pattern for us as we deal with these struggles in the days ahead. And give us the grace and wisdom to do that, we pray, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, we got a few minutes, and the time is yours. Comments, questions, anything that you'd like to share? Maybe you'd like to share something. Something that I've said has resonated with you, and you've proven it and experienced it, and like to just give a little testimony to it. Let's take a few minutes for that. Any questions or comments or observations? You're just so stunned, aren't you? The devil loves to take advantage of those situations. Good, Doug. Thank you. I performed the marriage of that daughter. So I don't have the pain that Doug and Helen have. But I have had pain because it's a heartbreaking situation to us all. Thanks, Doug, for sharing that. No, the I am in trouble.
Okay.
Yeah, the I am in trouble.
You mentioned that with the first point.
Yeah.
The acknowledge who God is. So
yeah. Okay. The I am is I'm in trouble.
I'm in trouble.
The second is I need. And the third is I will. I will love you. I'm committed to you. I trust you. It's affirming my commitment. Yes.
And you've only got three here. I am, I need, I will. So I thought the I am is acknowledging who God is.
Yeah, yeah.
The great I am.
Yeah. The first one is you are.
You are.
The first one is you are. And then the last three are I.
Okay.
So you begin with God. You are, you say, you do. Okay, you are, that's the attributes of God. You say, those are the words of God. You do, those are the actions of God. And you can take an afternoon just thinking through those three aspects of God. And the more you do that, the better you'll get to know God. At first it becomes a little academic and cold theology kind of thing. But as you do that, it becomes part of us. And you begin to, and then you see that worked out in our life, and you begin to know that God really is sovereign, and God does really act graciously, and he is faithful, and so on like that. So you are, and then I am. Yeah. Okay? Okay, Joan, thanks for clearing that up. Good. Now, you know what Christian hope is? Popular hope, cultural hope, is wishful thinking. You look out the window and say, boy, I hope it doesn't rain today. Well, that's not going to change one bit whether it rains or not. Sorry to let you know that. But you can wishfully think. That's hope. Culturally. But biblical hope isn't that. Biblical hope is confident expectation. It's something I confidently expect because God's such a kind of God. I confidently expect because God has made a promise. I confidently expect that to happen. And so that ties in just with what you're saying. Joan, you are so smart, I just can't believe it. You're getting smarter as you get older, you know that? That's right. Good for you. We have this hope as an anchor for the soul. We have this hope as an anchor for the soul in the book of Hebrews. Yeah. So that's what the anchor symbolizes. You know, we sing the song, "Will your anchor hold?" You want to play a little game with some people your generation. The younger generation don't even know the song. Sorry about that. But with your own generation, ask them sometime, what's the anchor? You know what they'll say? God? Jesus? No, that's not the anchor. The anchor is fastened to the rock, which will not move. The rock is God. The anchor is fastened to the rock. So what's the anchor? See? Hope. We have this anchor as hope. A confident expectation. That's the anchor in the middle of the storms of life. And so, you know, God, I know you are. I know you'd say. I know you do. And I confidently expect you to keep your word. That's the hope. I confidently expect you to act wisely, to do what's the right thing. That's the hope. That's part of the Christian life. That's Christian hope. Okay. It's shuffleboard time.